Are we back on my bullshit? Is that what's happening right at this juncture, at this moment, at this current epoch in time? Epoch, E-P-O-C-H. I think that is in fact the case. Huh. Well, you and I are as surprised as I am. Let's phrase it that way. And I make no promises that this will be a thing that continues into the ether, into the time immemorial, ad infinitum, et cetera, et cetera. No, there's a good chance that this is a one-off. This is an experiment. This is a let's get back into the form for a brief period of time. And why, of course, might one do that? Well, one, as what seems to always happen is, you know, I'm going through a spell of moderate to severe depression that then gets kicked out by doing something to shock to the system and break into a creative mode. And then once you get into the creative mode, then it's the floodgates open and you're in this vibe where all you want to do is create constantly, except for then when you watch Netflix and then you continue down the spiral and eventually end up right back into the same multi-month hole. Is that a fly? It's too small to be a fly. Or is it like a fruit fly that's flying around my head? I can't tell. I'm not sure. I'm not at all positive. So certainly a combination of that whole, hey, let's, you know, take advantage of this momentum, take advantage of the fact that the brain is buzzing, take advantage of the fact that I am in the zone, in a space wherein I want to be doing projects of a sort. But if we're being entirely honest, while that is certainly a major motivating factor, it's not the only motivating factor. The other motivating factor is, hey, guess what's been the through line of this fun little project relatively consistently? Namely, the fact that I like to talk about Taylor Swift a lot, and oh boy, do we have some things. Oh, my gal. My gal. Oh, my lordy. I had to take a sip to process. But that's not all. That's not all. It's in the life. I mean, you know, I've watched the first season of Riverdale twice now. I just finished season two of Wynonna Earp. Sweet Vicious is a television show that has come and gone in the interregnum. Terrace House as well. The rise and fall of my love of the Bachelor franchise. Oh my lordy, yeah, no, there's so many sort of assorted pop culture shenanigans. Charlie Bliss became the only good band in the world. What even else? Kitty came out with a new album. We have so much to discuss. Most of the fact that Riverdale's the best television show I've ever watched in my life. Ah, oh my goodness. I mean, I love me a good teen drama. I love me a good teen drama. I love me a good show. In order to be a good teen drama, there's a few things it has to do. Number one, it has to be over the top, but over the top in a way that, like, it's taking the insane... It has to both take the insane things that it's adding onto the premise that are, like, much bigger and grander than an actual teen in real life would ever have to deal with. It needs to take those seriously. So it needs to be, you know, larger than life. It needs to artificially inflate the drama for no reason other than it's a television show. At the same time, it also needs to take seriously the dumb bullshit that teens think are really important when you're in high school. It needs to understand that silly things like who you're going to a dance with, you know, for one of several dances in one of several years of this very, very small portion of your life, it genuinely feels like it matters, and because it feels like it matters, that means by definition it does matter, and so you need to treat it as such. And so what it, my moral of the story, what I'm trying to say is I love me a good teen drama. If a teen drama doesn't use the fact that a school dance is the perfect set piece for a big final climactic moment of an episode, then it's a teen drama that is doing things wrong. Riverdale uses a big dance as the climax point of an episode not once, but twice, and maybe three times. Well, I guess we're counting a party than three times. Also, if it's a good teen drama, what it has to do, it has to have that moment where the kids throw a party while the parents are away and it gets out of hand and they learn a lesson. Riverdale. Boom. We got it. That being said, that was the one episode that I couldn't rewatch in full because it gives me so much unbelievable anxiety to just, like, know that, oh my god, even though I know that in this particular circumstance, nothing really goes wrong for these kids because they're the leads in a teen drama. Fine, whatever. It's just so much anxiety to be like, oh my goodness gracious, what's going to happen? What's going to happen to them? How are they going to handle? How are they going to deal with the fact that like their parents are going to come home and their parents are going to be mad at them, especially when their parents are Luke Perry, and Luke Perry is so great and so cool and is the only like consistently start to finish, like always straight and narrow, doing the right thing, being awesome in that entire show. Well, of course, I Love Me, My Betty, and My Veronicas, and My Jugheads. Luke Perry, Dad Andrews, Daddy Luke, Daddy Construction. He plays it right. He plays the game correctly. He's just out there trying to look for his, trying to take care of his son who makes exclusively poor decisions constantly at every opportunity. Except in the finale, he redeems himself, I think, or not necessarily redeems himself, but like shows that, oh, okay, in this consistent way that we've seen this character who, yes, constantly makes bad decisions nonstop at every available opportunity, there is like a through line to this character that would lead him to perform the acts, the relatively selfless acts that he does in the finale of the first season. But yeah, we gotta have a dance. We gotta have a party, a secret party. We got to have. You know what we gotta have? Here's what we gotta have. It's not a teen drama if we don't have moments where you realize that the parents are even more fucked up than the kids are. That the parents are the real immature ones. That, oh my god, that's a chef kissing fingers emoji, which isn't an actual emoji. It's a thing that should be an emoji, but you have to sort of hack it together by using a combination of one of the kissing emojis and the AOK symbol. It's a good emoji. But yeah, you've got to have that moment where it seems like, hey, you know what? I think maybe the adults are actually the fucked up ones. They're behaving more like teenagers than the teens are. That is how you know that you have a good teen drama. And of course, like, part of this is the self-selecting of, like, what are the kinds of teen dramas that I like? I like these high drama, silly, over-the-top shenanigan-y ones. I prefer your Gossip Girls. I prefer your Pretty Little Liars. I prefer your Riverdales. Like, that's what I look for in a teen drama. I do need to watch more of The OC. I watched a little bit of it, the first couple episodes, and it was fun. It was good. It was old. I think there was an element to which I was like, oh no, I'm raised on the Gossip Girls. I'm raised on the late 2000s and the 2010s shows that are, you know, slickly produced and modern and stuff like that in the correct aspect ratio. And the OC did, you know, it felt more like a network show of the early 2000s. But I'll give it a try, especially because, you know, it's not Josh Charles. I always want to say Josh Charles, but Josh Charles is, in fact, the actor on Sports Night and The Good Wife and not the creator of The OC and Chuck and Gossip Girl. Josh Schwartz is the name of that particular person. Chuck was also a show that I really loved. It was when I first started, like, watching TV as a thing that was actually on TV as opposed to, like, oh, I'm a kid that's watching a kids' television show and I don't have any conception of seasons and I don't have any conception of, like, you know, long-term story arcs. It was, yeah, around 2005, 2006, 2007 was when it was like, yeah, TV's a thing. Let's start paying attention to that. And so the shows that were on network at that time, particularly on NBC, are like those first rounds of shows that I sort of remember watching and remember liking. So it's your 24s, but not the first seasons of 24, the later seasons of 24. Chuck, Heroes, The Office, which was an ABC. No, The Office even was NBC as well. Yeah, dang, I watched a lot of NBC shows. But I'm thinking, like, you know, that is how we first started to get into TV. But, you know, also you'd have some of your CW shows. I think Reaper was one that I was big into. But then, yeah, that's sort of how you like are straddling the line between the, oh, TV's just a thing that's always on and you just watch whatever's on versus TV is like a narrative form that you're following and paying attention to. That 70s show is a really good one that sort of straddled that line of like, no, I watched that 70s show the same way I watched Reba, for instance, or King of Queens. Nope, it's just a sitcom that's on at a certain time. The Simpsons, even, when I first started watching it. And then like starts to transition in the later bits of like, oh wait, no, that 70s show is a you can process it the way that you process the rest of TV. Anyway, Riverdale absolutely has that wonderful thing of, oh, the parents, maybe they're the ones that have the real problems. Maybe these kids are like the ones that have their actual heads screwed on straight, which is really good because Riverdale is a murder mystery. And so if the characters that are investigating the murder are all teenagers, you need to have a way to make them seem competent and not be dealing with the insanity that is a crew of kids that are trying to investigate the murder of one of their classmates, which would seem insane unless you try to build them up a little bit. That being said, I'm thinking about myself. If one of my interesting thought that I literally never had at any point in one, the two times now that I've watched the first season of Riverdale, if a classmate of mine, oh gosh, this is going to get dark right now. If a classmate of mine in high school had gotten murdered, would I be part of the plucky young crew that tried to figure out what happened? Ooh, boy. All right, to thine own self be true, I know that I would be obsessed with it. I know that, like, as someone who, you know, has always been obsessed with true crime, has been obsessed with serial killers, things like that, it would be a combination of not only that, and then also, like, the deaths that the fortunately, you know, blessed to not be super, you know, too many deaths that have a direct impact on me, but even the ones that do, and even the ones that do that aren't, like, much of a direct impact, have sort of been a haunting thing, and that, you know, take on an outsized importance in sort of my own personal narrative and my own worldview. And so, gosh, and heck, imagine if it was, like, actually someone much closer, and a la your Jason Blossoms to the rest of the Scooby gang in Riverdale. I don't think I would actually get involved in anything, though. I think it would be a lot of sidelines obsessing and a lot of, like, the voyeuristic is maybe not necessarily the right word, but it's kind of on. If it's not the right word, it's a difference of degree, not difference of kind, in terms of, like, the way that I would interact with this thing that happened and would have happened in this fictionalized version of my own high school experience. That would have happened to the community. Yeah, no, I don't think I would Scooby gang it up. And so that is one way in which, while I am a Betty in so many other aspects of my life, I am not quite full on Nancy Drew, a la Lily Reinhart. Fun thing that I'm a fan of, if you follow the Riverdale cast on Instagram, there's this sense that Lily Reinhart is a little more the Veronica than Cami Mendez, at least from the versions that, of course, are, you know, portrayed on social media, which is always, like, you know, different people use different levels of, like, how much is that going to get you access to the quote-unquote real true persona of a person, with the caveats being, like, what is ever the real true persona of a person, blah, 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 isn't everything, the self is always a constructed illusion. But even what you think of as yourself is a constructed illusion that you create for yourself based on your memories, which are, you know, not real remembrances of things that happen, but are stories that you've told yourself about how things happen. But the Lily Reinhart is the one that's a little, she's much more of the, like, silly, sassy goofball compared to Cami Mendez. He's a little bit more of the sweetheart, judging by Instagram stories. So, you know, grains of salt that are boulder sized. Riverdale's a show, y'all. Riverdale's good, and I cannot even begin to wait until Riverdale returns to grace our screens. And I think October is when it comes back, and this is August right now, which means, will I watch Riverdale one more time before the show comes back? The reason why I rewatched it was because I started listening to a podcast called Cry Me a Riverdale. And the reason I started listening to Cry Me a Riverdale is because it's hosted by Mikey Newman, who is a person that I got into a month or two back, makes a YouTube series called Movies with Mikey. And I saw that, like, oh, he also hosts a Riverdale podcast, and I love Riverdale. Let's listen to Riverdale podcast. Wait, if he hosts a Riverdale podcast, I should rewatch Riverdale because Riverdale's really good. And I did. And so, yeah, I think there's a non-zero chance, given how many times I've watched, you know, I'm currently through, I think, my fifth, sixth, maybe even seventh rewatch of Sports Night over the years is happening right now. So, you know, who knows? At some point, I will probably go back and rewatch Riverdale, and It'll be a fun time. It's such a good show. That said, I am still only on season 3 of Pretty Little Liars. I did, yes, read all of the recaps and such of the finale that happened a little while back, because who cares? I don't care about being spoiled about stuff like that. I watched through to the end. I think, yeah, end of season 2 is when sort of the first big A reveal happens, and that was fun. And then I was like, all right, cool. I'll probably keep watching the show at some point, but at this point, just in case I don't, and also because I don't care about like twists and turns so much anymore, I'm going to read the Wikia articles about this and learn all about stuff. And y'all, that show seems to go off the rails based on my reading of Wikia. It's fun though. I like me a Pretty Little Liars. I wanted to think that I was an Arya, but in fact I'm a Spencer. In fact, I'm a Spencer. I'm a Spencer who wishes she was an Arya. I'm a Betty who wishes she was a Veronica. I'm a Serena who wishes she was a Blair. It's just, this is how it always goes. This is how it always goes. I don't wish I was a Georgina in Gossip Girl, but I wish I was friends with Georgina. But I also wish that I wasn't, because Georgina would destroy my entire life. But she's so cool in a genuinely sociopathic way. Speaking of potential sociopaths, so, yeah, it's a song. It's a song, ain't it? Look What You Made Me Do is a song. It's a song. And it's, so, roller coaster, up and down. Listened to the song for like 45 minutes straight, right when it premiered, the new Taylor single. And it, you know, it's a song that you can do that. You can just sort of listen to it on loop. And like, yeah, it sort of vibes along. Obviously, aesthetically, it's wildly different. Aesthetically, it's also not really the type of stuff that I vibe with in general. And certainly not like, if we're looking at, oh, what are my favorite Taylor Swift songs? They tend to be on the bubblier side. I tend to really like the bright pop rock of, you know, Love Story, You Belong With Me, etc. We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together, 22. The also sort of bigger, brighter, pure pop stuff like New Romantics, Shake It Off, you know, even if it's sort of the mellower stuff like Blank Space, which I adore, you know, it's still major key, still sort of doing its vibe thing. The only sort of like quote unquote dark Taylor that I usually vibe with is like the sort of dark country stuff. The Should Have Said No is my favorite song for the first album. But even that's more of like melancholy. So yeah, so I like melancholy Taylor a lot more than I tend to like angry Taylor, if that makes sense. And that's just purely from an aesthetic point of view. That's not a like normative judgment of one is better or one than the other, or even necessarily saying that, while I do think that she does melancholy really exceptionally well, I don't think that, you know, there's an argument to be made as to whether or not she does melancholy better than she does other things, or that just I like the way she does melancholy more than I like the way she does other modes. But I don't know. The song as a song is fine. And actually I've started to vibe with it a little more. And, a thing that sort of made it click, interestingly, is I was watching a dance video. And I think one, the combo of seeing the dancing go along with it is like, oh, okay, this is a song that you can dance to. Maybe not necessarily like in a cool, fun, like white kid dance. Let's go wild at a drunken dorm party that you could for like here We Are Never Getting Back Togethers and Shake It Offs, but in a way that like, oh, actual people that dance can dance to this in fun choreographed ways. But also, frankly, what made it click was hearing it on this video, dance video that I was watching. You were hearing it over the speakers, not, you know, just with a, you know, as a backing track. It was like a backing track live in the room, and that little extra reverb and that little extra echo, and coupled with like the hoots and hollers and cheers of the rest of the troupe that were watching whoever the soloists were that were dancing, like, oh, now I sort of get the mode that this song is playing in, of like, it's much more clubby in sort of an 80s 90s vibe. It's much more about like over the top ostentatious dancing. It's much more like in the mode of sort of 80s 90s gay club hits, which is a genre I'm not really that familiar with at all, so like I can't really it makes sense that it would take me a while for me to click on that, and also that like I wouldn't really be able to describe it and point out the ways in which it plays into those that modality, that genre. So we're seeing it in that context made be like, oh, this is the context for how this sort of song is supposed to work musically. Seeing the video then, which came out, sort of cleared the stage for, oh, this is the context that we're supposed to see the song in thematically, in sort of the narrative of Taylor Swift as a person, which is like this weird blend of hyper self-aware and, Taylor Swift has always sort of struck that interesting line between exceptionally carefully curated and carefully manicured image and having the vibe of authenticity, and I think, which is always a tricky wicket for any artist to go down, even the ones that are sort of your quote unquote authentic artist, it's still a chosen, carefully selected veneer. Hey, because again, the self is itself an illusion that is constructed in all circumstances, even when you're thinking about your own self. But with this song. Usually with most Taylor Swift songs, there's the question of, do you take it at face value, or do you posit that there is something behind the scenes? And if you're positing something behind the scenes, usually because the face value is this sort of earnest, authentic with a capital A, aw shucks, rootsy, homey vibe, then if you're not going to take that at face value, you're going to assume that, oh, in fact, it is cold and calculating and cynical behind the scenes. Those are sort of the, one, they're presented as opposites and, like, in opposition to each other. I don't necessarily think they are. I think that Taylor Swift is a perfect example of someone who has both, and both are genuine, and that's what makes her interesting. And it's just the choice of which ones do you present at which time, and again, it gets this whole separate idea of, like, can something be authentic when it's also curated? That's a weird way of saying it. Curated. An authentic song is not one that is, you know, carefully produced and carefully written by a bunch of people in a room. And it's like, well, sure, but also, like, every choice that goes into a thing is a choice, and it's a choice that's coming from a person. And arguably, I would say that, like, for one person, their authentic expression of self might be what they do, caveat self is an illusion, what they do after spending, you know, 10 months carefully crafting everything and throwing out everything that they don't want in it, and like that is their expression of self, where someone else, their expression of self, preferred expression of self, may be one take improv, let's go, let's just do the dang thing and get it done with no editorial. So yeah, I guess this thing is like, maybe not curated isn't the wrong word, that editing doesn't make something less authentic or less of an authentic expression, I think. Not that necessarily makes it more of an authentic expression, but like both are authentic expressions of choices that are made, and those choices are coming from people, and therefore they are reflections of the beliefs and the thoughts and the aesthetic values of the person that's making the thing. You have your Taylor Swift, you have your, so I don't necessarily think that the two are in contradiction of like hominess and artsiness, the hominess and folksiness versus cynicism and carefulness and planning. But that's sort of the usual dichotomy that's presented, especially sort of coming up as a country person, and country really values this one particular version of authenticity, the sort of folksy, rootsy, that is the version of capital A authenticity that is valued and promoted within that genre and that style of art. And here with this song, because it's a song that like mocks and sort of leans into an image that's been created for her, it sort of throws that all into skew. And I think that's where I'm seeing a lot of the tension and a lot of the concern happening, is that we have a pretty clear narrative of, oh, if you like Taylor, then you assume that she is, you know, she is the folksy front, and that's her authentic version. If you don't like Taylor, then you assume that the folksy thing is all the front, and in reality she's cold and calculating and cynical. And here we have something where the front that is portrayed is cold, calculating, cynical, angry, doesn't care. And like that's the presentation. And so then you run into this thing where, oh, all of the, if anything, all of the people who would give shit for a, you know, red era folksy song, now are giving shit for the, or even more so for like a love story or a You Belong With Me, are giving shit for the surface level presentation and then not really engaging with what might be behind that. And we're in the different circumstance where then the people who are the sort of the Taylor Swift defenders are the ones that are talking about what's behind the words and like carving and creating narratives that justify the vibes of the song and like where the song fits in with the popular conception of Taylor Swift as sort of this more villainous character now than she has been in the past. And I don't know, it's interesting. The video for the song then takes that to an extreme and also just executes it way better. I think the song is a subpar execution of whatever ideas she's trying to get out, where the video, again, I think it has some missteps. I think the clearest version of the execution is in the last chunk, where it's the mountain of Taylor Swift's that are crawling up and being kicked to the curb, and then especially in the skit at the end is like, oh, okay, I see what we're going for here. That is a perfect encapsulation of what your sort of idea that you're going towards in this particular project. But yeah, I don't know. And of course, all of this goes without saying that we know nothing about what the album is going to be like. We know nothing about whether this is a plot point in a narrative across the whole album, whether this is just the shot across the bow to break off and throw away any conception of like, which is something that Taylor Swift does, is that she tends to like to have her first single be the planting the flag, especially Red 1989 and now this, of you thought you knew everything, throw everything else out. This is not necessarily saying this is what we're like now, but rather saying what you, I guess her lead singles aren't there to set the table for what is coming, but rather to clear the table from what was there before. We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together is a really big, bold flag of like, oh, it's not that kind of country. It's this Max Martin-y pop sound. But it doesn't really sound like a lot of the other songs on the album. Even more egregious is Shake It Off, of like nothing on the album sounds like Shake It Off, but more importantly, nothing on the album before sounds like Shake It Off. So I guess that's also the question, is like, we don't know whether it's going to be a plot, whether Look What You Made Me Do is a plot point in a larger narrative of the album or the general theme that the rest of the album is following. We also don't know if aesthetically and stylistically, if this is more focused on throwing away the past than it is setting up for the future, or if it's vice versa. It's meant to be like, this is part one of everything that's going to come later. I don't know. It's an okay song is part of it also. Like, if this was an A+ pop banger, then all of this would sort of take a backseat to the fact that the song was really good, which is interesting. So now we get to talk about these fun cultural and artistic sides and bits, because we aren't burdened by the fact that the song is actually a number one jam. But I need some number one jams, Tay. You can't give me a whole album of just sort of middle of mediocre pop music. I need some good stuff. I need the good. But yeah, it's a Taylor Swift song. We could not talk about it. Right? You agree. I don't think I'm going to publicize this. I think I'm just going to like put it on the feed and see if anyone is still subscribed to it. Yeah, I think that's a move. Philadelphia.